I think we can. Podcast interview number one, Tuesday the 23rd of September, Nick Clegg. Nick, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us. You're coming up to York on the 30th of October, mm-hmm. and you're going to be talking about liberalism in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. What is liberalism in the 21st century? Surely liberalism is the same whatever century you're in.
I think it's a good point. It is a set of enduring values and principles, but they of course need to be updated, refreshed, reviewed in line with changing circumstances and you know, heavens above, our world is changing around us at a dizzying pace, just as the news of the extraordinary, you know, collapse and change and churn in the financial markets show. But I think what is enduring about liberalism in whatever century, in whatever decade, is that liberalism starts and finishes with a particular understanding of power. I think liberalism believes that the world is a better place, is more secure, is more content, is more fair, if power is dispersed and not hoarded, and if it is held to account, and if it is transparent. And this works on so many different levels. So that liberal instinct is what's always driven liberals to believe that over-centralised government is a bad thing, because it neuters local communities, deprives local communities of doing what they can do best for themselves. It's why liberalism has always been so antagonistic to any infringement of individual civil liberties, liberties which liberals believe to be inalienable, not something that can be traded or amended at will. It's why modern liberalism in particular has always believed that to make sense of the world around us, we need to share power with others, whether it's in the European Union or multilateral organisations, that power in a globalised world no longer fits in the neat little boxes of the 19th century nation state. And perhaps most importantly of all, that power at home means giving people every opportunity to get ahead in life, to fulfil their dreams, to pursue their ambitions, to exploit their talents, irrespective of their background. And I think one of the great crises for politics, and certainly one of the great sort of issues of preoccupation for me as a leader of the Liberal Democrats and for all liberals, is why on earth is it that we live in a country, the United Kingdom, where so much money has been spent in the name of fairness, and yet we live in a society which is so socially immobile, so segregated, so unequal, and that is not a liberal society. So I think it's all about dispersing power and giving people, communities and nations as much chance, if you like, to cooperate with each other and to get ahead themselves.
Would you then, I mean, it doesn't sound like you make a very big distinction between the theory of liberalism and how it comes across on the ground, how it really affects people in their everyday lives.
Oh, well, no, sorry, I think you have to start from first principles, which is what I've sought to do. I think what it means in practical terms is very dramatic. A liberal British government would look utterly different to what it is now. We would have a much smaller Whitehall state. We would have much greater tax raising and spending powers in local communities. You would have public services which are not run by officials in London, but run through democratically accountable boards and organisations in local communities. In other words, you'd have a completely different political map. The tax system would be different. You'd have taxes handed back to people on lower middle incomes and loopholes which are only enjoyed by the rich closed. You'd have a totally different attitude towards foreign policy. We wouldn't have made the error of going into Iraq. We would be getting much more out of our membership of the European Union. So I think on all the big issues, public policy issues of today, liberalism, since it has been so abandoned by Labour and the Conservatives, would have a huge impact on people's lives.
But isn't there an argument that that particular form of government that you're talking about might potentially become incompatible with the way the world changes? I mean, we've seen the extraordinary changes that the globalisation of all things has made in the way we live our lives. Surely the system of government that we employ to deal with that needs to change as well.
I mean, I've heard the theory, and it's made by people, particularly on the left, that somehow the uncertain times and the kind of footloose, fancy-free insecurities of globalization mean that you need to have bigger government, more intrusive government, which can sort of extend a protective arm over a frightened and disorientated, you know, British population. I guess absolute rubbish. What you need, absolute rubbish, what you need in this very, very fluid arrangement is to give people and communities more power so that they can navigate their own way through this world. The idea, it's a very 19th century idea, it's extremely old-fashioned, this idea of the kind of great centralising paternalistic state fixing everything from the centre. How on earth is that supposed to match an environment where any of us, anyone listening to this podcast, can at the flick of a switch, the press of a button, marshal more information to them on their computer screens than people have been able to do for thousands of years? That kind of autonomy, that power, that empowered relationship between ourselves and the outside world is not yet reflected in politics. Politics, in my view, is the last bastion of the old society. And liberalism, I think, understands intuitively that the new society is all about the dispersal of power and far greater control for people and for communities.
You mentioned the 19th century there. We're talking in your office in the Houses of Parliament, and I've just walked past a statue of Gladstone. Do you think he would recognise the kind of party and the kind of politics that you're introducing after the changes that you made in the conference last week?
Yes, I think he would. I think he would understand the concept of fairness, not simply entrenching privilege but trying to release potential and opportunity and advancement by creating a tax system which doesn't punish exactly those people who need the most help. He would certainly recognise in our modern internationalism, something which of course he very much pioneered as one of Britain's great, if not greatest, prime ministers. So I think, and as a reformer, he was a political reformer. I mean, we always have been and we will always remain a party of political reform.
You were talking earlier about how you have to adapt, you have to interpret the same political ideas, but they manifest themselves in a different way because the world that we live in changes. We talk a lot about the challenges and opportunities open to our generation in particular. As I say, you've just changed a lot of your party's policies on things recently. What are the challenges and opportunities that you are trying to line yourselves up for over the next 30 years or so?
Oh, I think there are many challenges. I would single out, for instance, the environment. This is clearly one of the great sort of dark shadows that hang over our generation and future generations. It needs a complete step change in our energy policy, how we house ourselves, our international relations, how industry is structured. So that's obvious one way. But I think all the changes that we want, whether it's on the environment, whether it's on greater social justice and fairness, whether it's on international relations, none of them, I think, become possible unless you change politics itself. And I think that's something which the Conservative and Labour parties have never understood. You can't change the world around you and keep Westminster in a little, fossilised 19th century bubble. You can't hope to liberalise British society in the way that I've talked about, giving communities and people greater power over their own futures, if you hoard all power in this kind of bizarre Alice in Wonderland world that is the Westminster Parliament. So I think in 30 years' time you will see a completely different kind of politics, and I think we will be the catalyst for that change.
So there's a bit of a challenge in there, in that it's got to be changed, but also an opportunity to presumably do things like getting more people involved at a lower level of politics. What form do you suppose that might take?
Well, by definition, it takes lots and lots of different forms. This form, you and I talking about, talking on a podcast recording that people can download on their own computers in their own living rooms, their own bedrooms, groups, campaign groups, campaigning to save some natural countryside in their own neighbourhood, campaigning against a development they don't like, the sort of bottom up charities and and voluntary organisations that now, you know, have sprung up across the country and I think are often sort of under-recognised. Politics itself is, of course, for the vast majority of people involved in it, a voluntary activity. Politics is actually kept alive by people, not like me, not paid politicians here in Westminster, but by people knocking on doors and delivering leaflets. It is a classic example of the community spirit, you know, coming alive. So I think, by definition, it's something which is incredibly diverse, very, very rich, and wonderfully impossible to control or monitor, which is a good thing.
We're seeing and hearing a lot about the American elections at the moment. Do you think there's a lot that we can learn from the States in how we run a political system, or would you rather we branched off into completely new territory and set an example for the rest of the world in the way we did our politics?
I think the dangers of following the American political example are greater than the benefits. The American political system has A, been hollowed out by big money, and B, has presided over dramatic levels of abstention and, frankly, disenfranchisement, particularly of large numbers of poor black communities who just are now no longer stakeholders in American democracy at all. I think those dangers are greater than the kind of whiz-bang, modern media, you know, razzmatazz components of American politics that people always say we should emulate. Some of these campaign techniques are often pioneered in America. I mean, I myself sent over a delegation of Liberal Democrats to America over the summer to follow the party conventions, and we've already started to adopt some new telephone canvassing techniques. But that's the kind of thing which is only interesting for people who follow the nitty-gritty of campaign techniques. But in terms of the relationship between money and parties, and between parties and the electorate, no, I don't think we should emulate America in the slightest. As someone who, you know, knows a lot about European politics, spent a lot of time in European politics, I'm endlessly frustrated that the kind of British sort of political and media establishment retain this slavish devotion to all things American and seem completely oblivious or indifferent to things which are taking place 30 miles across the Channel. Huge mistake in my view, because frankly the politics of Spain, Germany and France, and to name just a few European countries, are just as important collectively than what goes on in the United States.
One of the ways you personally are looking to develop this new spirit of politics is, I know you spend a day out of Westminster every week, don't you? One of the things we do is try and spend a lot of time talking to people such as yourself, as politicians, but also a much broader range of people in the arts, in business, in academia, and all that sort of thing. Do you think that in the 21st century, politicians have, to a certain extent, devolved a lot of their ability to change the world? Hmm. Do you feel, we were talking about Gladstone earlier, do you feel more or less powerful as a senior political figure than somebody in the past might have done?
Oh, of course. I mean, undoubtedly. It's exactly what I was saying to you earlier. What Westminster has not yet woken up to is that power has migrated to so many different places. It's whether it's upwards to international institutions, whether it's downwards to community groups, whether it's sideways to multinational corporations. This Westminster still inhabits this fictional universe that everything can be fixed from Westminster. It's just, and that's why I think politicians and governments keep getting it wrong, because they keep claiming they've got all these levers available to them that they don't. And one of the things that politicians in this country, in my view, need to do is to learn how to be more realistic and modest about what politics is able to deliver. I happen to think that politics still is incredibly important. I wouldn't be doing this job if I didn't. But we don't have, you know, the world is not at the beck and call of politicians as it was even 30 years ago. And I think that's probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing. Some cases, I don't know. I mean, when I hear the Conservatives, for instance, saying that their solution to the NHS is to create some whopping national quango and take it out of the reach of politicians, I think that goes too far, because I think it should be a subject of political debate about how we provide a health service in this country. I so happen to think in another area of policy, monetary policy, it is right to say that you want to take the setting of interest rates, which is actually quite a technical issue, out of the hands of politicians, and we were the first party to call for independence of the central bank. So you do need to choose, I think, quite carefully where you decide to opt out, where you decide to withdraw political influence from. But it's clear in the kind of, you know, the 21st century that that particularly in economic matters, the power of politicians is much circumscribed. Though I would say that what we might be seeing at the moment with this extraordinary turmoil in the financial markets and this astonishing intervention in the free market by a so-called ideologically free market Republican administration in America might well be judged in the history books to be the final chapter in a particularly kind of hands-off free-for-all as far as global markets are concerned. This might actually be the beginning of a much more interventionist regulatory approach from governments towards markets.
From what you're saying, it's a very exciting time to be a liberal.
Mm.
Were you always a liberal? I mean, I'm sort of interested. You're coming up, or you will be going up to York to speak to students there.
Yep, much looking forward to it. End of the month, isn't it?
Yeah. That's right, October. I mean, you weren't massively involved in student politics when you were a student.
No, I wasn't. I'm afraid I've got a worse confession, and I don't want to insult anyone who's actively involved in student politics listening to this, but not only was I not involved, I was actively repelled by what I saw. But you've got to remember, you know, place and time is important. So I was at Cambridge University as an undergraduate in the mid-80s. No, hang on. When was I there? 86 to 89, I think it was. So this was the height of the Thatcherite revolution, and all that students wanted to do was kind of enter into a sort of dog-eat-dog world of, the city advertising, the new sort of glitzy professions. Margaret Thatcher declared society as dead. We were all just atomised individuals struggling to tread on each other's toes and so on. And so the kind of dominant political spirit of the times, which I sort of witnessed briefly when I sort of went to the Cambridge Union on one or two occasions, was an incredibly kind of harsh, braying, unforgiving, unimaginative kind of politics. And I just saw these red-faced students bellowing all these certainties when I was like any other student. I had big questions. I had instincts and preferences, but you know, I think being a student is as much a voyage of, you know, it's a time of discovery, not a time to sort of claim that you know everything and you've somehow got all the answers. So at that time, politics was going through quite an ugly phase, and that was reflected in student politics. But I'm sure now it's utterly different. But at the time, it didn't attract me.
Brilliant. Well, we're very much looking forward to having you, and all the best for the next few weeks, and we'll see you up in York.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
You've read my briefing sheet, haven't you?